Hi, this is Mark Iverson, owner and founder of Ida History, a Boise area small business devoted to historical tours and content. And lately, I've had a question. Question based on a term. A term that I've heard thrown around the political arena and the news perhaps too often. And that is real Americans and the real America. To me, America is a place full of diversity in thought, religious belief, culture, history, and political views. To claim that you are a real American and you comprise a real America is to say you possess something, possess a nation built on how you are and what you perceive to be right. And of course, to me, that is relative to who you are and where you come from. And so I wanted to talk to Americans, great many Americans, Americans from all walks of life, all colors, sexual orientations, genders, religions, and etc., and see what they think a real American is, or if there is a real American. And I want to get their experiences down in conversations recorded, because when you get a person's experience, you understand them a little bit more. And thus, you empathize with their situation and their reality in America. And so, join me. This is the Ida History Conversations Podcast. Thanks to the Trendy Dads for that great piece of music to cover of the B-52's Private Idaho. All right. Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in again to whatever this thing is I got going on. But the Ida History Conversations Podcast, if that's what we want to call it. But, you know, I'm sitting here with, well, you might know her as...
Socialistically awkward.
Right. And the new host of City Cast Boise, right?
Yes, yeah.
And that's like a whole thing across the country.
Mm-hmm. Yep. It's one of, I believe now, 12 city-based podcasts around the country that, yeah, we just report on what's happening in the city, a little bit of state issues, but just try to keep people up to date on what's happening in Boise.
I like it because it's short and to the point. I don't listen to them all, and I've just started, but, you know, I listen to one on, homelessness and some other ones that I'm not recalling right now. What was the other one I listened to? But they're all good. I like it how they're quick. I need to do this on this podcast a little bit more, but I don't know. Sometimes your conversation goes to different places, right?
Yeah.
But one thing I noticed about what you do is there's a great amount of research behind it. And as a historian, you know, I really like that. But what is in, I think, sticks out to me is you get more listeners, you get more attention. I would say you have to be more spot on with the facts you're finding, because they're going to come at you from all sides.
Yeah.
Is that something that's in your mind as you're researching? Or is it just like, I want to find the best facts and I'm going to leave it at that?
I think a lot of it, especially when I started specifically with my TikTok, there was so much information, so much misinformation, so many different conversations happening that, especially, you know, I really started during the beginning of the pandemic, and I really wanted to kind of cut through that bullshit. Like, here's what's happening. Here's what you need to know. Here's what you should be aware of. And then that just kind of morphed into talking about political things that I also am interested in, because again, there's a lot of terrible things happening in our state. There's a lot of scary things happening in our state. But I want people to have actionable information, mm-hmm. and correct information, because I don't want people to feel, I don't want people to have incorrect information and not get the healthcare they need, or have incorrect information and feel unnecessarily worried about something that won't be a problem. And I saw that on a lot of social media. I don't think people necessarily meant to, but it is easy to make people feel scared and worried. And right. I want people to appropriately feel the, you know, how they're going to feel with the correct information.
And there is a nice sprinkling of, I don't want to call it rage. Sometimes it's rage.
Oh, yeah, no, sometimes it's simmering rage, yeah.
Okay, so let's just go to your background, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because this all kind of who you are now comes from who you were born as, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're born, I know, in Montana. Glendive, Montana, of all freaking places. That's where my father is from. And I've actually been there a couple times. There's like some crosses on a hill. My great-grandfather, Theodore, Norwegian people, right?
Yeah, lots of Norwegian people in that area.
Lots of Norwegian people.
Yeah, some of my people are Norwegian.
Right, I can tell. And, you know, they lived in a garage, you know, so it was an interesting life for my father. He was poor, but he liked Glendive for the most part. You know, a big move to Helena, like when he
was... Oh, that's the big city.
That's the big city, right? And I remember there was a place called Gertie Burger that I like had a 1 pound burger that I thought was amazing, so I ate it as a kid. But I have fond memories of Montana and Glendive. But how long did you live there?
We lived there till I was 12 or 13, and then we moved to Rigby, so from tiny town to tiny town. Yeah, and then grew up in, you know, spent the rest of my childhood in Rigby, went to BYU, Idaho, because I was raised Mormon.
Right, and so BYU, okay, they have a great archive. They have a lot, that's what Mormons are known for, their
Mormons
genealogy.
Mormons love history and genealogy, yeah.
I was a little nervous joining FamilySearch because I was like, I've been offered the Book of Mormon 3 times now because I find Mormon history interesting.
Oh, it's very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know, there is a history of oppression of the Mormon people.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, reflexively, there is also oppression being done by the Mormon people.
Oh, it's a very mixed bag. But growing up Mormon, you are taught only really one side of it.
Right.
There's a very strong victim complex, and we were oppressed, and we had to leave the country. And it's not wrong. They did have to leave the country and settle in Utah, but it's very complicated. They gave as good as they got, so...
Right, yeah, I've heard people like talking about Missouri when they were I forget the town in Missouri that they were in, you probably...
It was in Jackson County. There were a couple of different towns in Jackson County they were in.
You know, one side will say, well, we were ostracized and we were cut off from, like, mainstream society and all these things, and then the other side will be like, well, you did that yourself, and you were being financially, you know, you're financially powerful, making money, and, you know, Joseph Smith's doing this, you know, and so, you know, I never know what exactly to believe because I usually stop there when I get handed the Book of Mormon, but it's kind of a compliment in a way, you know, it's like, I think you would make a good Mormon. I'm like, well, thank you. I love Nine Inch Nails. Do you guys listen to that? Like, do you like Black Sabbath? Because, you know, people think I'm Mormon when I don't have my rocker shit on.
Yeah. No, if Mormons or LDS people are giving you that compliment, they think very highly of you. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's like, here's the other thing is I think basically all religion is bonkers to me. You know, no offense to religious people. That's my own personal view. I might as well be fighting over Harry Potter, you know, and like which character you like the best. To me, religion is all made up, you know. And if you don't agree with that, that's okay. But back to you, because this isn't about me. But Mormon history, right? So what do you think? Is there an agenda? Like a school district has a sort of... they have a mandate. They have a narrative that they want to tell to create certain types of individuals. Would you say there was like an over, you know, arcing kind of narrative that the Mormon Church nationally wanted their children to be taught?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, that's baked into the culture and the everything. And I mean, you can see it like as a high schooler, you go to seminary, which in Idaho and Utah, you like leave school during school hours. You have like, it's called an off hour or, you know, a break hour. And you, instead of doing a class at the school, you go to a Mormon building on adjacent to school property, and you learn more about Mormonism during school hours every single day. And so, like, that's what they're doing for the high schoolers. But yeah, the whole Sunday school, everything from when you're little is, you know, you're taught it's the one true church on the earth, that all of the other churches are sort of true or have some truth, but Mormonism has all of the truth.
Okay.
So it's the one true religion, hand given by God to Joseph Smith. You spend lots of time studying the Book of Mormon, a little bit of time studying the Bible, but not much.
Okay.
And then there is a very strong victim narrative that, you know, we were oppressed, we were kicked out of the country, and that is a sign that Mormonism is more true because of how oppressed they were. That's, you know, Joseph Smith was martyred in the Mormon narrative.
Right.
It's more complicated than that. He, you know, he was fighting back. He had a gun. But the story is he was martyred, and so he died for the truth, and so that's how you know it's more true. And then your job as a Mormon child, Mormon adult, is to, like, do the best you can, but spread that gospel everywhere, because Jesus is going to come back to earth, and you have to do everything you can to prepare for that.
So it's an evangelical religion,
mm-hmm,
in that sense. Okay, yeah, I mean, it's not the only, obviously, Christianity itself
built on
a martyr, you know,
yeah,
foundation of martyrdom. You know, it's not the only third religions throughout the world, and I've studied some of them. So, you know, yeah, but I have also found that, yeah, sometimes, you know, the most oppressed people can also become the oppressors.
Oh, right? Absolutely.
And we're seeing this right now.
Yeah.
You know, in Palestine. It was an
interesting mindset, because I no longer identify as Mormon, but with this idea that you are chosen people, that you have all the truth, that you understand what is happening better than other people because you have more truth, and that everyone is watching you.
Okay.
And you need to be the example. You need, you know, everyone is wanting to know why you, you know, Mormons talk about, like, oh, you have this Mormon glow about you. You have this look in your eye. Oh, yeah, all Mormons will be like, you can spot another Mormon because of their glow.
It's just the sun on their white skin.
It is, it is. But that's one thing, when you leave Mormonism, they'll say, like, you've lost that light in your eyes. You've lost that glow. Because you no longer believe. So that was really shocking, actually, leaving Mormonism and realizing everyone didn't care what I was doing, and I wasn't some example to the world. No, like, nobody really cared, and nobody was looking at Mormonism and being like, wow, they really have the truth. They're such good examples. I was just like, oh, that's, you know, they're kind of different. That's
right.
Kind of different, a little interesting, but kind of weird.
So how did you kind of start to question Mormonism? Was it history? Was it just how you were being treated?
It definitely started with the ordained women movement. So within Mormonism, men have priesthood power, which
right.
is basically to be in charge of everything. And so it is it's take, like, the patriarchy in the United States and distill it a lot. That's Mormonism. Like, it's
right.
so much more patriarchal. And so there was a movement in 2012, 2013 that was addressing that. Like, hey, you know, there were meetings women couldn't attend. Women couldn't go into a church building without a man in the church building.
Wow.
There were, like, they'll always say, like, Relief Society is the largest women's organization in the world. It is a organization that is run by men. It's the largest organization for women in the world run by men.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, no women in the Mormon church or the LDS church are ever in charge of men. So, like, 11, 12 year old boys get the priesthood. They have more authority, power in Mormonism than any woman,
mm-hmm.
than all women. And so there was this movement, like, hey, it was just simple things like, women can't even do accounting for, like, the individual wards. It has to be a man. So women would be like, I'm an actual accountant.
Right.
And they've got Bob, who works down at the car dealership, being the accountant for the ward. Like, why does that make sense?
Right.
Like, and so this movement was pushing against that. And that was something I had always had an issue with, was the inequality and the sexism. And so I was like, yeah, wait, this doesn't work. This isn't okay.
And was that at BYU?
I was living in Rexburg at the time. I wasn't going to school then. And then Prop 8 also, like, I was at BYU Idaho when they sent out flyers to have people in Idaho, in Rexburg, do call banking for California for Prop 8. Now, the Mormon churches denied that, said they didn't do it. They 100% did. But that was one of the big ones, too, where I was like, I can't get behind that.
Right.
I'm bi. I can't get behind that. So it was just like, and then it just kind of built. And then, yeah, I found out more about the history. There were people who had, you know, different blogs and different things that covered more of the history. And then the Mormon Church released these essays to address these major historical issues. And that's just when it all fell apart. Because basically the essays say like, okay, yeah, there are major issues and huge problems. And maybe we weren't honest about things. And yeah, this didn't happen like how you were taught. And so it all just kind of, like, realizing this organization that you were told was the most true, the most honest, the best. And then they're like, these historical things that we told you were anti-Mormon lies are actually true. That all just kind of led into a faith crisis.
Well, and so then you get... obviously, I can see now that you're just all about information. Like, you're very interested. I don't know you very well, but I can tell, and we've had a few talks, I guess. And it seems like you get hungry for information.
Yeah.
Like, I've never been, like, repressed from what I can study, really. You know, my parents, my dad had all sorts of, you know, 60s-era literature. You know, he was a... first time in the 70s, and my mom too, liberal people, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, I had a big old welcome back Cotter for you, you know, people from the 70s. I don't know if you even know that reference, but...
I don't.
yeah, he's a 70s teacher. He just looked totally 70s, like sideburns and everything, big, like, white dude fro. That was my dad. And he had, like, he had James Baldwin and Ellison and, you know, all sorts of Ivan Doig. He had all these authors and thinkers on the bookshelf downstairs, and so we were all filled with. So I never was repressed from information, and you know, I was a lazy ass until I was 26, and I started reading, you know, because I was going to the Peace Corps, and I was like, I might as well start reading, you know, not something other than Jurassic Park, you know, and for me, I would find it very hard to be cut off from information, and I still have my gripes, you know, I'm like,
yeah,
that's not real. I would see, like, you know. Obviously, I'm not a woman, but I would imagine if I could put myself in your shoes, you get education, you're trying to figure out, you know, you're in this organization run by men, but for women. I would imagine that would just piss me off.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm not, you know, for any of your listeners who don't know me, I'm not a quiet person. I'm not a meek person. And I do have this strong sense of justice that when things don't feel fair, I want to figure out why and I want to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, no, like you said, and that probably honestly drives a lot of what I do is I feel like information was kept from me. I didn't have information to make decisions.
Right.
And so I do. I want to know everything about everything. And so if I'm interested in a topic, I will just like go down a whole rabbit hole for weeks. I want to know everything about it.
Right.
But I was like that within Mormonism too. Like, with the recent things going on, I was a Christian Zionist, absolutely 100%. And I would have these debates with one of my friends who was pro-Palestinian.
Uh-huh.
And we would go back and forth. And so that was kind of like my Roman Empire of 2009 to 2012.
Okay.
And so I would just like research different councils, different who, you know, this government official, this Oslo Accord, that, you know, all of these things. And because I wanted to know everything about it to defend Israel to this friend.
Okay.
It did the opposite. Like, when kind of like with Mormonism, if you dig deep enough, you realize
right. It's
not what you thought. And so that's, you know, but even then, like, just I voraciously want to know everything about topics. I like to know as much as I can about everything.
Right. I mean, and there's for me, it was nationalism. I wanted to understand the history of nationalism. I'm looking at, you know, Serbia with this idea of it could be based on religion, history, religion molded together as they mostly always are. But you have these imagined communities where in the minds of people, they possess something that another group also claims as theirs. And to bring this back to an American context, can dehumanize minority groups.
And, oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and in the Mormon sense, if you're a patriarchy, you use what I call, you know, craft and memory, mm-hmm. not history, but you label it as history to control women, you know. And I would think that would be hard for women, especially, even, you know, they go to BYU or wherever, but they go to college, they start to have access to more information.
Yeah.
I think. I've never really gone to BYU's
yes.
library.
It was like, there were different subjects. Teachers really did, some of the professors did a good job, yeah.
Well, so to me, history would be a big part of liberating my mind, I would mm-hmm. imagine.
Yeah.
What if it was, what topic did you really start delving into that you wanted to?
I think one of the things that really, the first time I went to college, I was a political science major, history minor. So I always loved history. I always thought it was really just interesting. Mormons love this, like, here's our history, here's where we came from, and you derive your sense of self from it.
Right.
And so I think, yeah, just this idea of deriving a sense of self and understanding of the world through history was always something I really identified with. Something that, this is so, so, so Mormon, but something that really kind of triggered, you know, me maybe looking more into Mormonism or thinking about, like, wait, why is history portrayed this way?
Uh-huh.
Is polygamy is a very still present topic within Mormonism.
Yeah.
So it's not currently practiced where people will have multiple wives that are living. Asterisk, divorce is weird. It's complicated and sticky. But it still is something that is believed to be a God-given commandment.
Okay.
And so it's just a sticky, Mormons have a sticky relationship with it. And I have polygamists in my family history.
Okay.
But something that always kind of like irritated me is when you talk about polygamy, you talk about the men.
Right.
And okay. And you only know the man who was the polygamist. And you don't know what wife you came from. Doesn't matter unless it was the first wife. We never talk about the wives. How many wives? Where were they? What were they doing? What were their lives like? We talk about the men.
Right.
We talk about how they went to jail. We talk about how they had favorite wives, or here's a funny story about them escaping the law, or here's a funny story about how they picked up this bride and their wives didn't know about it. You know, those are the stories that get passed down. And I hated as a woman how these women have been lost. We don't talk about them. We don't talk about their lives. We don't talk about their stories. We don't talk about who they were, what they did. Like, they were just as foundational to that structure and that society as men, but we only talk about the men. We only know the names of the men.
Well, and that makes me think of, you know, women as belongings.
Yeah.
Essentially, and there's no need for an identity from a female unless she's, like you said, the favored wife.
Yeah.
Or whatever, you know, I mean, that, how are women supposed to form an identity in that atmosphere? You know, like, I think the more I do this podcast, the more I realize how fragile, the most fragile people on earth are, like, white dudes. You know? I, like, walk around, and, like, now when I get pissed, I'm like, oh, man, I've talked to so many people that have it, like, way worse than I do. You know, and I actually find those people interesting to me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, that's why I'm talking to you, because you interest me, right?
So, oh, thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, no, I mean, everybody I've interviewed on this, they interest me, and I want to learn about something that I don't myself experience, you know, and what you're talking about, I'm way the fuck out of my field of knowledge. You know, as far as, you know, I watched Big Love and read that Under the Banner of Heaven, that's about all I know, so I'm no expert.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, and obviously I haven't read the Book of Mormon, but what I get from the women I've heard from about this is that they feel like objects, or they don't feel their individuality. And so polygamy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Did you go back to, like, the primary sources to challenge that? Did you go want to find, like, the old school information?
Oh, yes. Yeah, actually, that was one of the huge steps, kind of. Well, I never do anything by halves. I'm 100% all the time. So I always had a big issue with polygamy, and I would tell my husband, like, I have a huge issue with this. I'm not down. I'm not okay with it.
Right.
You know, it doesn't sit right with me. So we went back to the scripture, and I've been out for a decade, so I can't remember. It's like section 121 or 132 of Doctrine and Covenants, whatever.
I know it well, yeah.
Yes, yeah. And when we were starting to have this, like, faith crisis or faith questioning, we just sat down and, like, verse by verse went through it and looked at all the footnotes, cross-referenced everything. You know, it references things in the Bible, so we checked with that and went through, and we were like, this is not congruent with any of the rest of our beliefs. And so we actually wrote this big blog post about how Joseph Smith practiced polygamy, how Brigham Young practiced polygamy, how they didn't practice with what this supposed scripture that was supposedly the will of God said it was supposed to be practiced like.
Right.
How these scriptures aren't congruent with other scriptures within Mormonism and within Christianity. Did this whole blog post, posted it, waited until my husband got his bachelor's degree from BYU Idaho, had gotten it mailed just in case. Posted it.
Right.
And then we were threatened with a disciplinary council.
Oh, okay, I've heard of this
yes,
before.
Yeah.
Okay, the Council of Elders. I'm
yes, imagining. Yeah, and it's even that is sexist, because if that had happened, because my husband has the priesthood, because he's a man, he would go in front of the High Council. So 15 men would decide if he gets in trouble. Because I'm a woman, it would just be a bishop and his counselor. So it'd be the difference between this high council for, like, the whole region.
No shit.
Versus, like, just your pastor and his buddies.
I think I'd be like, fuck that from the very beginning. But then you don't get your degree? Or, like, can they bestow on you?
They can excommunicate you. So, yeah, if you're excommunicated and you're still waiting on your degree from a Mormon university, they can deny your degree.
No shit.
So we were like, wait a second, let's get the degree in hand and then we'll post it. And then, yeah, they were like, we're going to have a disciplinary council. We talked to our stake president who was, everyone was concerned, take it down. You can't post it. I was like, I didn't give up my right to ask questions. Like, Mormonism is founded on the idea that a 14-year-old boy was asking questions of God. So I'm like, we're asking, what's wrong with us asking questions? Why can't we ask questions?
You can't ask those questions.
Yeah, no, you can only ask the right questions. And we were still quite believing in a lot of principles of Mormonism at that time.
Okay, so, like, there was some threat.
Yes.
That you felt.
Yeah.
It's easy for me to come along and be like, I'd be like, fuck you guys now. You know, but yeah, I've never had that. I went to my buddy's church because I wanted to play basketball. It's an evangelical place in Kirkland called Antioch Bible Church. And, you know, they'd be like, this is an open place to discuss whatever, you know, and I'd be like, why you guys tell everybody not to vote for these candidates that support, like, gay people? And you'd be like, moving on.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I was like, you can't ask those questions. So, yeah, it became this whole thing where they're like, we need you to take it down. And we're like, no, like, isn't this, like, you know, different leaders and prophets of Mormonism have said, like, no question can harm us if we have the truth. You know, then all will be revealed. You know, like, if we don't have the truth, then we should, you know, there should be an issue with the church. You know, it should be harmed. And so we were like, no, like, we're going to ask, like, have an answer or don't. And so that was actually, a major factor in us ending up leaving Mormonism, because they're like, we're going to, like, discipline you if you don't take it down. And I was like, can you answer the questions or not? Like,
right.
That really is the issue.
And then they probably had I'm imagining a bunch of rhetoric and BS that they probably threw out there to not answer the question, but, like, act like they're answering it. But maybe they just didn't say anything.
Oh, yeah. No, there was a lot of, like, you need to honor your priesthood leaders. You need to have faith. You need to humble yourselves. Lots of even, like, you must be sinning. Are you guys sinning? Like,
every time I get a chance.
Because that's the only reason you'd ask questions, is you must be sinning.
Okay. Well, everything you're saying is, I can't stay on topic with things like this because I have a million things that are going through my head when you say these things. But what I was thinking is a foundation for a good marriage. I mean, shit, you guys leave that together.
Yeah.
You know, that's a, you know, he essentially, you change for each other, but he, you led this process, it sounds like, or was it?
There was leapfrogs. Like, we would kind of leapfrog each other where I'd be like, I haven't, you know, because he had his own issues with Mormonism too. And we kind of just would like leapfrog each other a little bit. So mm-hmm. it wasn't always a concurrent journey, but we were taking the journey together. But yeah, no, it was really, for any ex-Mormons listening, it is a really difficult thing to leave a high intensity, high demand religion with a spouse. And I also, this all kind of like kicked off like a month after I gave birth to our youngest. So,
oh my God, that's a lot.
It was a lot. Right. That's not the ideal time to do this. So you don't really get to choose though.
Yeah. I, from what I've noticed that pregnancy can change a person.
Yeah.
Namely a woman.
Yeah. Postpartum period is not ideal right. for any, for like life. And then throw in that a faith crisis. And yeah, it was not my favorite. But, you know, we made it.
It happens when it happens.
Yeah, you don't really get to choose.
I tell my wife that, my dear Michaela, that, you know, I'm a feminist for the most pure reason, and that's for financial gain, you know. And you know, there would be no, none of this, none of what, well, you went on my tour, there'd be none of that, you know, my crime tours, which are starting to pay off without my wife being at the top of the food chain in counseling in Ada County, right?
Yeah, but, yeah. Which the tours are really great, by the way. It was super fun. I had a great time. I highly recommend them. So
yeah,
I wasn't paid to say that, so no, that's for real.
I was curious to see how you'd react to some of my jokes, but you snickered. You know, so I was happy. And then your friend laughed too, but yeah. I felt like I had to earn those. But it was good. Like, some people just laugh their asses off. But, yeah, some of my favorite type of people are ex-Mormons. You know, I knew a bunch of dudes that smoked weed and liked the Green Bay Packers, and so mm-hmm. I'd give them shit about how they bought into the stock of the Green Bay Packers. Why are people always Green Bay Packer fans? That's a different topic. But the other people that I know, like, there's this person down in Utah, and she's a lesbian woman, and surprised me saying that there were, you know, like, actual, you know, gay bars in Salt Lake.
Yeah.
I was like, do they serve beer higher than 3%? And I don't know. I forgot the answer to that question. But she was on some morality board. Her wife was on some sort of morality board at BYU.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That was how they were presented with the bullshit. And, the, you know, like, and one of them was brought up.
Oh, yeah, no. Yeah. I had roommates kicked out and all kinds of discipline in college for doing really normal college things.
Well, you know, the other thing that I heard about Mormonism, and I think I actually read this a long time ago, too, but it's been so long that when I see, you know, an African-American person that is Mormon, I'm like, yeah, but doesn't Mormonism say, like, they're the son of Ham? And that, like, they... you're looking at me like
it's an urban legend, but it was referenced in a book by a prophet as supposedly said by someone else. So that's kind of how slippery things in Mormonism are. They say, like, the doctrine in Mormonism, it's like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall, because everyone can find what they want, and then they can reference things to make, like, see, this is doctrine, and then other people can reference other things to be like, no, it's not. So it's kind of like a choose-your-own-adventure where you can just pick what you think is really real.
Right.
And then other people can't. Because that's... I have people say the same thing with, like, how could you be a woman in Mormonism? Well, because you can find really affirming things that different leaders have said about women.
And you can latch onto that.
And yeah. You can hold on to that for a long time.
Right.
And kind of ignore the really crappy things. Or be like, well, maybe they were mistaken. Maybe they didn't know. And so that's how a lot of people stay in Mormonism, is you can latch onto the things that make sense to you. And then you just really have to work on ignoring the other stuff. And I could only do that for so long.
You know, okay, when you're talking about any sort of doctrine, right, a religious mm-hmm. doctrine, you can have, you know, zealots, and you can have, you know, extremists that,
yeah.
that look at that. And then, you know, look at the Bible, okay? Like, you want to talk about slippery, you know, the Catholic Church, the Orthodox Church.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they took Gospels. Was it Pope Leo X? I read a book, was so interesting. It was really dry, but it was full of good information. By a gay man named John Boswell, and it was 1990. This comes out in 1991, and he passes away because, you know, the AIDS crisis. Mm-hmm. And so we lost a great historian, but he just dissects Christianity and homosexuality. The name of the book is, you know, like, Homosexuality and Christianity, or the reverse. But, you know, he talks about how, really, if we're looking at how people view, you know, the religious right, basically their grounds for really, in most cases, hating anybody that is, you know, from the queer community. And not saying all religious people do that, but it, their book that they say, oh, this says it's so bad, it doesn't even really say that to
you. Yeah.
You know, it's like sleeping out of wedlock with a woman is worse because you can have offspring.
Yeah, or you can't divorce. Like, there's some, it's again, it's the picking and the choosing. And to really hammer it home with Mormonism, until 1978, we always talk about the priesthood ban for black members of the church.
Right. Okay.
The men can have the priesthood. Oh, it's so much worse than that.
Oh.
Because not only could men not have the priesthood, no black person could go to heaven in Mormonism.
That seems to be an issue if you're...
Yeah. And so that, like, that kind of gets missed, that it wasn't just about the priesthood. It was about, to go to heaven in Mormonism, you have to go to the temple. You have to be able to go to the temple and do ceremonies there. And black people were not allowed in the temple till 1978. So within Mormonism, no black person could go to heaven until 1978.
Holy crap. Wow. And then there were Mormons that were black people back then, right?
Mm-hmm.
I
mean,
it sounds like a naive question, but really? Yeah. Yeah, that seems like it would be an issue to get converts, because you're going around the world and, like, you know... missionaries in Bulgaria. I got to hand it to Mormon missionaries, though. They're going to a place with an entrenched Orthodox Christian culture, and they didn't get treated so nice all the time.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm like, they learned the language, they tried to learn the cultures, but then they stand out there in their suits.
Yes.
You know, and us Peace Corps volunteers would walk by, you know, like, smoking and drinking and just like, man, you guys are fucking crazy. But we give them a little bit of respect, because you got to have some fervent faith if you're going to go stand out like that.
Yeah.
So, but I would imagine if they must have gone to Africa.
I think it was less, but there was some, that was the big problem they were running into, is that, you know, this whole, like, it's supposed to spread to the whole world, and they were wanting to build temples, but it was starting to get tricky trying to figure out who is black and who is not, because race is a construct, and so how do you suss out exactly who qualifies and who doesn't, you know? And they were having a huge issue with that in Brazil, where there's been lots of intermarrying. There's lots of different races, and like, how do you suss that out? And so that was the complication they were running into, is all of these leaders down there were having to write in and be like, well, I'm not sure, like, they don't know their genealogy back far enough for us to know if they're black at all, it was getting complicated for them to be so fucking racist.
Right.
So that was, you know, that was a huge factor in them being like, oh, well, actually, God changed his mind. Black people can go to heaven now. So.
It seems like something that they have to kind of work around. And I find that as times adapt, they change, they evolve. It's all relative, I guess, to your opinion. But I think they, you know, are evolving in some ways, so that's why you're seeing such a backlash of fear and rage right now. But, you know, religions do have to adapt or die. And you get Vatican II back in the 1950s. You know, Vatican I was very... That's my favorite horror movie genre, is Vatican I, because you get the strict priest with the scary crosses.
Yeah.
You know, scary Jesus cross. You know, that's very much... Like, that's what I want to see in a vampire movie. You know, I want to see a fucking scary Jesus cross stopping a vampire. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. But... one thing I notice about religion, it's so tied to the development of any nation, you know, and, you know, again, in a Serbian context, you know, Greek Orthodox Church, you know, the Orthodox Church, Greek, you know, they're defining their nationality around the Greek Orthodox Church, but the Serbians also form their own Serbian Orthodox Church, and then you get, like, Montenegrins, and the Bulgarian Orthodox Church, and it's like, that's, like, we have the way. This is the right Orthodox Church, you know, and they all have little differences in doctrine. But I find that when we form America, you know, that idea of a city on a hill, right? It comes from, I forget the man's name, but these preachers that would walk the Eastern Seaboard and spread their idea of religion. And it's like, this America is that shining city on a hill.
Yeah.
Democracy, obviously, for the people that came over and defined democracy by their belief system, but it is also based on this type of religion.
Yeah. Well, and Mormonism was born in that time. And so it's very much a reflection of that idea of American exceptionalism. That is something very baked into Mormonism, is that the U.S. is the chosen land. Like, that's kind of distinct from other Christian religions, but they believe that the United States is God's chosen land.
Nauvoo, right?
Well, Nauvoo is one of the... Yeah, well, and in Missouri, they believe that's where the Garden of Eden was, or where Adam and Eve went to after they left the Garden
of Eden. That's why the Chiefs win all the time.
There, yeah, yes, it's the Jesus factor.
Yeah, yeah, right? Mahomes.
I know, you should have had your football team be
right
there.
The Garden of Eden.
But so that is all... When you put it in a historical context, it makes sense, because it was born at that same time of these preachers teaching all this American exceptionalism. You know, God chose, you know, and for Mormonism, that creates this narrative that is very easy to confirm your belief for you, because it's like, see, this is the chosen land. We won the revolution. We won the War of 1812. Mm-hmm. Look, the Civil War didn't destroy the country. You know, like, that's all baked into Mormonism. And so it's this, like, things that have already happened, but then you can look back and be like, oh, see, that's proof we're God's chosen country. And then there was a lot of manifest destiny within Mormonism that was part of that time. And so, you know, going to, like, history class as a young Mormon child confirmed to me my religion was true, because of how we teach history in this country focuses on our exceptionalism. We're so free. We, you know, the bastion of freedom. We're a light to the world. Those are all the same things I'm learning at church about this country, proving that Mormonism is real.
So what was it like to find out, you know, let's say African-American history or Native American history, you know, when you get out and you're like, oh shit, that's not what it's like for other people. Their America isn't such a shiny city on a hill because, well, you know, they're subservient to the, you know, even in that spectrum.
Yeah, no, it's really, I think it is very similar to the sensation of when I realized I wasn't special. Because yeah. Mormonism teaches you, like, you're very special. Everyone's watching you. You're an example to the world. And that is a huge ego destroyer to realize that's not real. And it was a lot the same with American history, that all of my history had been taught from a very white Protestant, you know, Judeo-Christian perspective, that, like, of course we have this country because of the Greeks and the Romans, and everything in all of history was leading up to this. And Mormonism teaches that too, that all of history was leading up to Joseph Smith founding the Mormon Church. Everything that happened was just for that. And everything that continues to happen is just for that. Like, computers were invented so Mormons could do genealogy. Like, that's kind of the mindset. So when you peel that back, and realize, like, oh, I was looking at this from a very white perspective, from a very, you know, U.S.-centric perspective. It is incredibly humbling. It is, like, you realize, like, leaving Mormonism, leaving all that, I realized I was basically wrong about everything in my whole life, which is devastating, but ultimately I think was a huge gift. And was a really positive thing for my life, but that it kind of destroys you for a while. Like, you don't know who you are. You don't know how you feel about anything. You don't know what you believe about anything. And it is really hard and humbling to realize, like, that you have been very wrong, very, in my case, very vocally wrong about basically everything. It really is just a pretty devastating experience. But in that devastation, now you have room to look at different perspectives, right, which is ultimately what you should be doing.
You know, I my mom worked in downtown Seattle, you know, so I've said this before, but on here, but, you know, just exposed to all this diversity when I go work at the Parks and Recreation, you know, special needs kids, you know, senior citizens, special needs adults, you know, and worked with all types of people, you know, Asian Americans, African Americans, you know, I'm sure a Mormon or two, but I don't know. But, you know, and it was, I have these moments where I was like gut achingly awkward white guy, you know, in front of, you know, a black woman she was the chef for this big camp we had. And, you know, I really did like Marvin Gaye, but I went in there right away. I was like, Motown. And I was just like, oh God.
You were trying to be cool.
Yeah. I was trying to, like, she must like Motown. right? Because she's black.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, yeah, she was listening. Yeah, right. And it was just like, she kind of did. Like, I don't know if she liked Marvin Gaye so much, but she liked some Motown stuff. It's like, but I mean, yeah, I kind of like Motown, but it wasn't my, you know, end all be all. I was a rocker, you know,
yeah.
Still a rocker. But, you know, why do I go right to that? You know, because
yeah.
We live, I wasn't trying to be a racist prick. I was trying to like, you know, but it's like, it's awkward enough. Like I had my own awakening and it's always a process where I'm like, oh yeah. Shit, the world isn't how I think it is. It's very different for mm-hmm. people that are different.
Yeah.
That have, you know, race is a construct, but whether it is or isn't, and it definitely is, people buy into it.
Yeah.
And there's been stereotypes just transmitted through culture since the Portuguese came up with this idea to make slavery okay in their minds, right?
Yeah.
In the minds of their people that they were trying to, you know, profit. You know, have they were trying to morally lay the land or the ground in front of, you know, the Portuguese and the people of Europe to say, oh, no, it's okay because they're subhuman.
Yeah.
You know, like when I started realizing that shit and I started reading and but it was really through firsthand, you know, experience, conversations with more people and being told like, no, you are ignorant.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was reading James Baldwin, right? Mm-hmm. Fire Next Time. Like, those things. And so what I'm saying is, it was hard enough to me to come out of that. And I was, like, a liberal family, a liberal kid, lots of books around. But we had, I mean, we didn't have any African-American people or diversity in the suburbs of Seattle.
Yeah, no, not a lot of diversity in, like, Rigby or
Glendale,
Montana. No, no, absolutely not. Yeah.
But I could only imagine, because I'm never going to experience that, but like what it must have been like to have a solid kind of idea of your history and your faith and then to have that rocked, you know, like, but I think, and I've seen this in other intellectuals that have, they're exmos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like there's a person on Instagram that I kind of follow, you know, when things pop up. Her name's Emo Lex, I think.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and she's like...
Oh, Exmo Lex. Yeah,
Exmo
yeah, yeah.
Lex, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Emo Lex, what the fuck?
Maybe. I don't know, maybe she's down with emo too.
But her and her husband, like, have just gone full on metal and, like, rock. And I'm like, good for you, man. That's awesome. Like, you became, like, an investigative journalist or something. Like, you know, like, and I think that's a very cool kind of, like, rock to stand on. You're like, yeah, this is what I want to do, you know. My friend down in Salt Lake City, she kind of, like, you know, works in social services, is really, like, an advocate for people experiencing homelessness. And like, I don't know. I'm sure that's not... every case, you know, I know.
Yeah.
But it seems like when you've been denied something and this freedom of kind of like the freedom to form your own identity.
Yeah.
Some people, it seems like, go all in, man. Like, I don't know. And you said something, I forgot. I was texting you or Instagram messaging you and I was like, yeah, you guys go all at it. And you were like, yeah, yeah, we do.
Yeah. No, it's kind of like you, when everything gets stripped away from you, then you do really get to find out who you are. Or, you know, you can, and you can either run from it or try to hide it again or just really dig in and find out, yeah, who am I? And instead of having your identity have to be built on these structures that you think are solid or real, like you get to redefine yourself and continue to deconstruct and rebuild yourself as you get new information, as you find out new things. As people say, like, that was really ignorant. Oh, okay, you get to incorporate that and rebuild. It doesn't have to be this. I think once you deconstruct like that, you continue to deconstruct forever. But I think that
right.
is
mm-hmm.
a really powerful and beautiful way to live, that it's never a process that's done, but you have to be open to do it because it is a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
It is. And I think, you know, we're sitting in a Meridian library right now, right? And we're having this discussion. And, you know, that's why I see this overall, you know, book ban. They call it a restriction, but they know what they're doing.
Yeah.
That's what they're trying to cut off. They're trying to do more of the same that was done to you back by, you know, your priest holders, you know. That's kind of a different way of going about it. They're trying to do that here. They're trying to control what people have the access to, you know, shape who they are and what they want to believe or at least learn about.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, you know, that's my big problem with it is like, you know, it's my job to indoctrinate my children and tell them what to read. Damn it. No, just kidding.
Like exactly what you say, like ideas are powerful and information is powerful. And what they are so afraid of is people having access to ideas and information, because when you give people access to ideas and information, everyone is going to land in a slightly different place.
Right.
And that scares them.
Right.
And that's why it's so important to have those things, because everyone deserves access to information.
Amen. But, yeah, history in the United States has been, you know, I used to be one of those persons who was like, fuck religion. You know, it's all bad. But, you know, then you get the Civil Rights Movement. You get Martin Luther King. You know, but then one thing I found out, we talked to Sheree Buckner Webb, and one of my all-time favorite professors is Professor Jill Gill. And she is she's an expert on states' rights, but she studies, white separatism and supremacy in Idaho and African-American communities in Idaho. And she brought in Sheree Buckner Webb to talk to us. And, you know, she was fascinating in the sense that she asked me, we were able to ask questions. And I just said, you know, she's like, I can tell you guys are a little bit nervous to talk to me. And she said, why? And I was just like, because I don't want to offend you, you know. And she was like, oh, trust me, I knew I had you pegged when I came in. And she was like, you mean well, but yes, you know, it was like, that was refreshing to know that somebody had, you know, used an accurate stereotype on my type of, you know, like scared white person that didn't want it. That was like 11 years ago. But one thing I asked her, and I liked her response, was, you know, how can people that fought for their civil rights, you know, Black Baptist Church, you know, how can they be so quick to, you know, come down on the LGBTQ plus community and their civil rights movement, you know? And, you know, now the answer is obvious, but she's like, you know, there's no, you know, end. Those who fight for justice can also be those who, you know, oppress others.
Yeah.
And fervently so in many cases. But then again, like, I was looking into the history of activism, of Black activism, and you have, what was his name? Huey Newton and the Black Panthers, and they kind of co-aligned themselves with the gay civil rights movement of the 1960s, 70s, you know.
Yeah.
And you know, it's like there's nothing simple to any of this identity forming.
No.
And that's why history, to me, all those things I'm talking about have been journeys, investigations, digging into things. I feel like you do that for me on things so I can like watch what you're saying. But I wouldn't do that if you didn't bring your research. Like you, as you're talking about things, you have like usually have some script behind you, you know, like going in the background or pictures, and you talk trash about people that I think are ridiculous. So that's helpful. They're so obviously ridiculous.
I was like, we can talk about what's going on. It should be definitely entertaining, though. Yeah.
Well, there's a bearded dude that's like a white nationalist up north somewhere.
Scott Herndon.
Yeah.
Commander Herndon.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Fucking dumbass. But anyway, that's my opinion. But yeah, I think he's the one who tried to like bring pizzas to a...
Oh, that was Dave Riley.
Oh, that guy.
Dave Riley doesn't have, well, sometimes he has a beard, not a long beard like Scott Herndon. Oh, yeah, no, I know way too much about the extremists in North Idaho.
They gaslight, you know, to an extreme level.
Yeah.
And the thing that's scary about some of these people is they come across, and I believe are, intelligent but ignorant. You know, you can have intelligence but also be ignorant. Or they know they're being ignorant but are trying to promote their worldview.
Yeah.
I talk about these false intellectuals like Scott Yenner, right?
Yes, absolutely.
He comes to my niece's high school, Eagle High School, and, you know, the people who are yelling the loudest are these jockey white dudes, right? Mm-hmm. They're just like... Yeah, you know, go back in the kitchen to these women, right, that are getting mad and standing up and walking out, and they're yelling these things. And then the LGBTQ plus people in the crowd are starting to get up, too, because he's trying to link them to pedophilia.
100%,
which has been tried and done forever.
I was going to say, that's a vintage, you know, you know, lobbed to throw at the LGBTQ community. They're pulling that from the 50s and 60s.
Right, but they're good at throwing bullshit out, but yes. trying to make it sound as fact.
Yeah.
And so, like, something like you do is, like, you kind of sit down and kind of deconstruct what they're going about or as much as you can in a, like, two-minute bit or whatever.
Yeah.
So I guess the last thing I want to know is, like, do you implement history in your research to come up with, you know, arguments to, you know, kind of, like, make your arguments?
I think absolutely, yeah. Like, I nothing that's happening now is new. It is a lot of recycled things from history. It's just been repackaged.
Right, right.
It's just, like, slightly relabeled.
Leftovers.
It is. It's none of this is new. We've seen this all before. And that's why part of what drives me is I'm like, okay, can anyone else see this? Can anyone else see what's happening? This isn't new. We've seen these things play out before in different contexts, at different groups, in different settings, in different times in history. But none of this is new. And that's what's so scary is we've seen how this plays out. And so... Absolutely. I think a big part of what I do is try to break down, like, okay, there's a, like you said, there's a whole lot of bullshit here. There's a whole lot of, like, sophistry in what they're saying and how they're presenting their arguments.
Right.
This is what they're saying. We've seen this before in history. This is what happens. This is, we have to take a stand, or this is what we have to say, or this is, you know, because it is, it's complicated. And the hard thing is people are living their lives. People are busy. People are stressed. People are trying to survive capitalism, you know, like on and on and on. And so it's hard. I get it. It's hard to keep track of, you know, the 628 bills every legislative session and how destructive they are. And what did this legislator say? And then nationally what's happening, and then internationally what's happening. And there's just so much all the time. And so what I hoped to do is, you know, try to take these issues that affect this state or this region or our country and just break it down. Because I think once you can break something down, you know, because people are busy, not that people are stupid. I think people are very smart. It's just busy and complicated on purpose. They, you know, these legislators make these things complicated on purpose. They try to argue like it's complicated and it's not.
Right.
And if you, the minute you break that down for people, then people will act. And I want to give people something. This is actionable. You know, I think most people in Idaho, they don't want their libraries closed. They don't want their books banned. I think, you know, maybe
numerically you're speaking, right?
Yeah. And I think, you know, even maybe this is me just being optimistic. I think the majority of people in Idaho don't care if their neighbor's gay or if anybody's gay or if gay marriage is a thing. I think it's, there's fear, there's complicating factors. There's things like you said, where they're, you know, calling LGBTQ people names. And then I think people are just disconnected and scared. And as soon as you can break things down, show them what happens, give it context, which I think often has to be done with history, then people feel empowered to do something, whether it's call a legislator, write a legislator, vote, you know, things like that.
Well, you know, on my tour you went on, we have a stop where I talk about the Ku Klux Klan in Idaho, you know, and really the only way to go with that is to go with the history of what they believe. And but, you know, like, you got to deconstruct those awful belief systems, right? So it's like, that to me is history, is taking, you know, you can go back to Thomas Jefferson and find the receipts, quite literally.
Yeah.
You know, New York life, you know, it's hard to take primary documents and say that didn't happen. You know, I read a book that my friend suggested, and it was about George Washington owning, quote unquote, right, but possessing somebody by force, right? Martha Washington, actually. It was her valet, Ona Judge. And, you know, I'm finding in this book, you know, and then I found more on the National Archives website, these orders where he's saying, yeah, go ahead and whip people, right? Mm-hmm. Or, and if that doesn't work, to correct them, send them to the Caribbean. Now, there's all sorts of, which was a horrible place.
Absolutely.
If you want to, you know, kind of like talk about slavery and horribleness on a spectrum, the Caribbean was as bad as it gets in many cases. But, you know, and he ruthlessly hunted this woman after she ran away in Philadelphia, where the White House, but the presence was, right? There's all sorts of other contexts to understand George Washington's frame of mind. He actually kind of knew, and there was a movement that understood that slavery was morally questionable. That's how they would put it back in the day.
Yes, yeah, give themselves that plausible deniability.
Right, Jefferson did the same thing. You know, but in some ways it's like, okay, yeah, they were kind of looking, you know, they're kind of looking at themselves in the mirror, but not enough to change what they were doing.
No,
right?
Absolutely.
And because it was not financially feasible for their families, right? When they died, they were like, well, that's our wealth. So it's not worth it to get rid of this. Like, you know, that's history. Like, I think people, yeah, if you read a book that somebody else has written, make sure it has loads of footnotes.
Yeah.
But I even find now when you're sitting there and you're using these primary source documents, and I've gotten in an argument with some woman on Facebook, so I shouldn't do it, but I'm using all these primary sources I found from Library of Congress, and she's got this big old Confederate flag behind her in her, you know, her profile picture.
Yep.
And I'm just like, no, this document says this, this, and this. Here's a speech by, you know, Jefferson Davis prior to him becoming the president of the Confederacy, where he's actively talking about, like, the rights of white people to own slaves. And it's like, how could you say it's not about slavery? And she's like, oh, you're just ignorant. I'm like, but I have all these sources.
Yeah.
So that's what I'm running. Like, even with all your information that you throw out there, right, it doesn't fucking matter to some people.
No. I have found if people have a stake in misunderstanding you, or what you say would require them to do self-reflection they are not interested in doing, or examining their beliefs, they will misunderstand you, or they will purposefully not understand what you're saying. And so,
right. Cognitive dissonance.
Yeah, exactly. And so I put it out there, and I know there's going to be the people who argue that I don't know what I'm talking about, or I'm wrong, or, you know, whatever. And we could have conversations about that. If you want to have a conversation about how I'm interpreting what happened or whatever, absolutely. But, you know, there will always be those people who just purposely want to misunderstand.
And you talk about that in an interview you did for your new job, where you're like, how do you kind of defend yourself or buffer yourself from the hateful comments? And you're like, if they hate me, that's fine, you know. And I found I've been getting more of that if I take a stand on something on on my Instagram page or profile, whatever the hell the kids call it these days. But I'll get some hate for it, and I used to like really flip out, but now I kind of just, I don't know, I'll try to play the peacemaker, and then I just like block them. But yeah, I'm trying to think about it that way, like, okay, it feels like a badge of honor, you know?
Yeah, I would say, ultimately, I don't care what they think about me. I don't have to feel okay about that. I don't care. I have to feel okay about how I feel about myself.
Yeah.
And so, if they don't like me, it's okay. Like, said earlier, it's a badge of honor. So, if you look at some of them, again, like, they're not good people. I'm fine with people who I think are really terrible people not liking me. I'm okay with that.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, you got to push on through that and get to the love of diversity and humanity and kind of just like, because I feel like it's a brighter world in the end when you know, like can sit down like we had and have a conversation and learn about somebody else, their experience. And, you know, like it's liberating to become a more educated, empathetic person, you know, and diversity is something that's great, you know, it benefits all, really. And so, you know, I guess that's what I'm going to fight for, but I'm glad you're up on the ramparts because no, I mean, I have started to kind of like, oh, I wonder what Socialistically Awkward has to say about this, right? Lindsay. I don't think we ever covered your real
name. Oh, yeah, my name's actually Lindsay. Lots of people don't know.
Right. But, yeah, that's a compliment in some ways. You know, you're into
thank
your...
Thank you.
But, yeah, you have my vote.
thanks.
Don't run for office. You're doing much more.
Yeah, no, that's not the place where I could affect change.
And if you get what more well-known, Mormonism's totally behind you. You can sign on to Scientology.
Perfect.
Right.
Perfect. Yep. From the frying pan into the fire.
Exactly.
That's the right jump to make.
You clear up or whatever they say. But, all right. Well, thank you for talking. And they can see you on or listen to you on CityCast Boise.
Yeah, CityCast Boise. Anywhere you're streaming podcasts. TikTok, Socialistly Awkward. Instagram, Socialistly Awkward. Sometimes Twitter, I'm debating Nazis, you know, just whatever.
Right.
Whatever you're in the mood for.
That's, and I'm actively using you, besides being interested in what you have to say, to get more listens. So that's perfect. Cool, right? All right. Bye. You're wrong, I'm in Idaho.